Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katya Adler, and today on The Global Story, I'll be looking at the rise of book bans in the United States. Over the past years, an increasing number of popular children's books have been removed from libraries across the US. Some parents say they have legitimate concerns. Others claim this is simply censorship. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Unmissable stories from around the globe. From the BBC World Service.
My happy place, this is who I am.
Search for the documentary, Lives Less Ordinary, and Amazing Sports Stories, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Friday the 19th of January, these are our main stories. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has publicly defied a US push for a Palestinian state once the conflict in Gaza comes to an end. In northern India, thousands of men have joined a recruitment drive to send workers to Israel as the war with Hamas has led to a shortage of labour. And the authorities in Ecuador have detained two people accused of killing a leading prosecutor in the latest violence linked to the country's powerful gangs. Also in this podcast, were false teeth the secret to Winston Churchill's wartime speeches?
There's four teeth together and then a gap and another two. So he obviously had six teeth taken out and these would fill in the gap.
We start in Israel, where the country's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has said that he's told the US that he's against the creation of a Palestinian state as part of any post-war settlement. Mr. Netanyahu used a nationally broadcast news conference to restate his position.
In any arrangement in the foreseeable future, with or without an arrangement, the State of Israel must have security control over all territory west of the River Jordan. This is a necessary condition, and it conflicts with the idea of Palestinian sovereignty. I've told this truth to our American friends, and I've also stopped the attempt to impose a reality on us that would harm Israel's security.
Well, those words from Israel's Prime Minister brought a critical response from his country's closest ally. A US State Department spokesman, Matthew Miller, insisted there is no way to ensure Israel's long-term security without a two-state solution.
We will continue to reiterate to the leadership of Israel, the government of Israel, and to the people of Israel, that these are the opportunities that they have, these are the challenges that they face, but there is no way to solve their long-term challenges, to provide lasting security, and there is no way to solve the short-term challenges of rebuilding Gaza and establishing governance in Gaza and providing security for Gaza without the establishment of a Palestinian state.
Well, having heard those words from the U.S. Department of State, and before that, Israel's Prime Minister, I got more from our correspondent in Washington, D.C., Tom Bateman.
I get the sense that the State Department, the sort of American machinery of diplomacy, is getting a bit frustrated and irritated, really. Remember, Secretary of State Antony Blinken spent a week in the region returned just over a week ago. And I think reading between the lines of what the comments we've had from Mr. Netanyahu today, you know, where he's used this phrase, from the river to the sea, must all be under the security control of Israel. And what the Americans were doing over the course of that week, Antony Blinken, Secretary of State, was going around the region and saying to Arab leaders, look, if you will basically help reconstruct, rebuild, and then crucially help with a plan to secure Gaza and get a sort of Palestinian-led governance going, then, you know, what are you asking in return? And what the Arab leaders are saying is a Palestinian state. So that's what's on the table. And the Americans are basically trying to push for this kind of arrangement, this kind of deal, where you would have the sort of long-sought two-state solution of an independent Palestinian state in the West Bank, East Jerusalem and Gaza, in return for a secure Israel. Now, unsurprisingly, Benjamin Netanyahu, who leads the most right-wing government in Israel's history, containing vehemently anti-Arab Kahanist, which is a sort of movement that believes in the forcible expulsion of Arabs. Some ministers in the government are from that movement. You know, he's always opposed a Palestinian state in recent history, has argued for it once under American pressure in the past. But it's no secret that he opposes a Palestinian state. Now he's saying it very clearly, absolutely rejecting it. And he says, I'm telling the Americans this. So he's playing to his own base, but he's saying it very forcefully. That's annoying the Americans.
So does this speak to a failure of diplomacy and a failure to try and achieve what Antony Blinken is trying to do? Or frankly, do the Americans know that pursuing the war is one thing, but what comes after is something different, and that's a longer game?
I have to be honest, you know, I've just spent nearly 7 years in Jerusalem, and coming over this side of the Atlantic and reporting on it from Washington, there feels such a disconnect between the diplomatic position and the absolute catastrophe of what is happening on the ground, you know, from the October the 7th attacks by Hamas through to this catastrophic war, massive loss of civilian life. And Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, was in Davos this week, and he said, you know, they want to try and get an independent Palestinian state in the short term, that this is basically something they're not going to wait years for. They think that this is now a historic opportunity for everyone to seize. But I think that you would suddenly speed from the events of October the 7th and the war to a two-state solution seems to me, you know, wishful thinking probably at best.
Well, let's stay in the United States, because the Biden administration has said that it has launched further airstrikes on Houthi rebels based in Yemen. The White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said the strikes destroyed Houthi missiles that were being prepared for use in the Red Sea. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams assesses the situation.
One thing we can definitely rule out, at least for the time being, is any notion of boots on the ground. The idea that the West, the Americans, the British, would wade into Yemen, having watched the war that Saudi Arabia waged in Yemen for years and years and years, that's just unthinkable. So the hope, clearly the hope in Washington and London, is that this military pressure ultimately will persuade the Houthis that this course of action, interfering with shipping in the Red Sea and lobbing the occasional missile in the direction of Israel, that this is simply not worth it. And of course, behind the scenes, there will be words being had with Iran, you know, effectively saying, look, tell your allies, to the extent that they will do your bidding, and that's, by the way, you know, questionable, but to the extent that you have influence over them, tell them to stop, because this is just not in anyone's interest.
Paul Adams reporting. Thousands of men have queued in northern India during a recruitment drive to send workers to Israel. Israel needs more workers because its month-long war with Hamas has led to a shortage of labour there. Ambrasan Etirajan reports.
Israeli media said the country was planning to bring in about 70,000 workers from India, China and elsewhere to meet the labour shortage. The construction sector, which had employed Palestinians prior to the war, had come to a standstill. Some of the Indian workers looking to go to Israel said they could make five times more money in a year there than they could earn at home. In May 2023, India and Israel signed a deal to allow around 40,000 Indians to work in the Jewish state, mainly in the fields of construction and nursing.
Ambrasan Etirajan. When a gunman burst into a school in Uvalde in the US state of Texas in 2022, hundreds of police descended on the area. But it took more than an hour for them to confront him. 19 students were murdered and two teachers. But 2 years on, and in an exhaustive report, authorities say the response was a failure and lives could have been saved if the officers had acted more quickly. Merrick Garland is the U.S. Attorney General.
Their loved ones deserve better. The law enforcement response at Robb Elementary School on May 24, 2022, and in the hours and days after, was a failure that should not have happened. We hope to honor the victims and the survivors by working together to try to prevent anything like this from ever happening again, here or anywhere.
Well, the report into what happened at Robb Elementary School is nearly 600 pages long. It found, quote, cascading failures of leadership, decision-making, tactics, policy and training. It also described a lack of urgency in the 77 minutes before the gunman was finally confronted and killed. The US Associate Attorney General, Vinita Gupta, gave disturbing details about the plight of those who survived the shooting.
There was no plan to triage the 35 victims in classrooms 111 and 112, many of whom had been shot. Victims were moved away without precautions. Without appropriate precautions, victims who had already passed away were taken to the hospital in ambulances, while children with bullet wounds were put on school buses without any medical attention. In the commotion, one adult victim was placed on a walkway, on the ground, outside to be attended to. She died there.
Well, after hearing details like that at Thursday's news conference, some of the families gave their reaction to the report. This man lost his daughter.
For these officers to sit there and just not do anything, you know, and still be out here, you know, on the streets like nothing happened, you know, and my daughter's gone. It was hard.
Well, picking up from that, I spoke to our North America correspondent, Emma Vardy, and started by asking her what is going to happen to some of those officers who responded to the shooting.
There is also a criminal investigation ongoing into the police response that is yet to conclude. Some family members want to see criminal prosecutions. They want to see resignations from the key officers involved. And family members are also bringing civil lawsuits against officers involved too. So that will have to run its course. But today, a lawyer representing the families said, look, families didn't need this hundreds of pages of a report to know that officers had failed, although they do appreciate that this has now been published, and that in a sense it does validate many of the criticisms that they had. But this won't be the end for families. They will keep on campaigning for change and potentially for much harsher penalties against the officers involved.
And let's go back to the failings that were exposed in such detail. I mean, why did it take so long?
It was an awful combination of bad communication, misinformation and confusion at the scene. The most significant failing that has been highlighted in this report is that officers who were first on the scene, they retreated from the classrooms and they treated the gunman as someone who had barricaded themselves in, not treating them as a what's called an active shooter in the US. They should have recognised the situation immediately, and if they had done, then the protocol is that they should have pushed forward and entered the classrooms until the gunman was taken down, until the threat was eliminated, and that wasn't done. Now, the police chief of the district, who was de facto the on-scene commander who arrived early on, he comes in for a lot of criticism in this report. It said that he discarded his radios on arrival, thinking they weren't needed. That meant that he was giving commands verbally or over mobile phones to communicate to the officers on the scene. There was no command structure set up. And he actually directed officers to pull back, not to enter classrooms. And had that been different, then potentially lives could have been saved. So a lot of criticisms at all levels here. And it will make very emotional reading for family members to imagine that all that time that police were stood outside classrooms, sometimes they were looking for keys rather than just making an entry, forcing an entry to the classroom where the gunman was and was stuck inside there, all the many victims and the teachers who were stuck inside there with him.
Emma Vardy. Next, let's go to Ecuador, where the authorities have detained two people accused of killing a leading prosecutor in the latest violence linked to the country's powerful gangs. The prosecutor, Cesar Suarez, was shot dead as he drove on a motorway on Wednesday in the port city of Guayaquil. He'd been in charge of the investigation into the assault last week on a TV studio as a live broadcast was taking place. Under the state of emergency powers approved last week by the country's president, Daniel Noboa, hundreds of soldiers have been deployed to a key prison in Guayaquil to take control. They've seized dozens of knives, other sharp objects and mobile phones used illegally by the inmates. My colleague Julia Marshall spoke to Carolina Loza León, a journalist who spent the day in Guayaquil.
It seems it was about 1,000 police officers that had gone into the early mornings to raid for any ammunition, guns in the prison cells. We know that all the inmates were moved outside and were caught by surprise, were sleeping, and then the raid is undergoing. They're still to find something. They have found guns and ammunition, but to see if there was any sign that there are signs of the organization coming from the jail to the assassination of the prosecutor of this case. It seems to be that the reason, but this has been going on. It's the fourth day that there's some kind of operation in that specific prison since the whole chaos started after the prison break of Adolfo Macias, known as Fito.
And are there any prison staffs still being held hostage, either at this prison in Guayaquil or elsewhere in the country?
No prison guards are held hostage. However, there's not much of a full control of the government in all of the prisons. So sometimes, because these are huge complexes, especially the one in Guayaquil, there are areas that are not under their control. And this is why they're carrying out these raids, especially as you mentioned, it's the nerve of the drug trafficking trade right now. It's Guayaquil, and that prison in Guayaquil is key. I was there yesterday in the outside. They don't let any press in. And it was eerily quiet. So there were no visitors. There are no visits allowed. Even the people that would have businesses outside, like food stalls, most of them were closed. So it was an eerily quiet and a calm yet tense environment that we see all over the country this past few years. It was the same outside the prison.
Well, that was the journalist Carolina Losa León in Ecuador. Still to come.
Until now, we didn't know that emissions that are created underwater, like bottom trawling, actually are released into the atmosphere.
Scientists highlight the dangers to the climate of the industrial fishing technique that drags vast nets along the seafloor.
This is the story of the charismatic Nigerian preacher, TB Joshua. Some called him a miracle worker.
He healed the sick, the lame walked.
A great man of God.
Others say they knew a very different man.
He's not this holy man.
What happened to me and to others shouldn't happen to any human being.
This is World of Secrets from the BBC World Service. Season 2, The Disciples. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Where do I see myself in 5 years? I want to buy a camper van. With a sweet solar-powered kitchenette. And space for my best friend, too. Yes, you.
Let's get started on your 5-year plan. CIBC. Ambitions made real.
Hello again, and welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Estonia has told the head of its branch of the Russian Orthodox Church to leave the country, calling him a threat to national security. The authorities say he has repeatedly refused to distance himself from the Kremlin and the government of Vladimir Putin. Our Europe regional editor, Alice Adderley, has more.
The 66-year-old Russian Bishop Valery Reshetnikov has been in Estonia for 4 years and has had several temporary residence permits. The current one expires on February the 6th, and he's been told it's not being renewed. Police said he had repeatedly been asked to stop justifying Russia's invasion of Ukraine and defending the Kremlin. The head of the Estonian Police and Border Guard Bureau, Indrek Aru, said the bishop's public actions and speeches were, as Mr. Aru put it, supportive of the aggressor.
In the case of this person, we have reason to believe that he represents a security threat to the Republic of Estonia. It's not related to the church in any way. It's related to a particular person. It's certainly not related to the religious movement in general. We don't see a problem there.
Neither the Russian Orthodox Church nor Valery Reshetnikov have made any comments since the announcement. However, in October 2022, the bishop said he was opposed to conflict.
I am against any kind of war. This has already been said in our messages, so there's nothing new to add.
The bishop's expulsion is the culmination of long-standing tensions between the largely secular Estonian state and the Orthodox Church, which is the country's biggest religion and is well attended by its sizable Russian minority population. Estonia and its Baltic neighbours are among the staunchest supporters of Ukraine as it battles against Russia's invasion.
Now, we're going to stay in Europe and stay with matters religious as well, because the Pope has declared that sexual pleasure is a gift from God. His comments came in the latest of a series of sermons on what he called the demon of lust. Some have interpreted Pope Francis's words as a defence of a newly appointed senior Vatican cleric. after that cleric was criticised for writing what has been described by some as a sex manual. Here's our religion editor, Ali Makbul.
Sexual pleasure is a gift from God, so said Pope Francis at his general audience at St. Peter's Square this week. It's not a comment that came completely out of the blue, but is seen by many as his response to traditionalist critics who've been taking aim at one of the most powerful figures in the Vatican. Victor Manuel Fernandez, an Argentinian who's close to the Pope, was made both a cardinal and the Vatican's head of doctrine last September. But it's also now been revealed that in the 90s, when he'd already been a priest for 12 years, he wrote a quickly withdrawn book called Mystical Passion, which included what he called research with a group of married couples about the difference in nature of the male and female orgasm. Catholic priests themselves, of course, are required to remain celibate. The fact that Cardinal Fernandez says even before appointing him to a senior position, the Pope was aware of his book and another he wrote on the art of kissing has incensed some conservative Catholics. They've long accused Pope Francis and those he surrounds himself with of moving away from the Church's traditional teachings. But the Pope's response now suggests he's not too worried about the storm around the book.
Ali Makbul reporting. It's been known for some time that the industrial fishing technique called bottom trawling, that's dragging vast nets along the seafloor, can destroy habitats. But new research has, for the first time, calculated another harmful effect – the amount of carbon that's churned up and released from the sea floor. The marine ecologist Enrique Sala is the senior author of the study and also founder of National Geographic's Pristine Seas project based in Washington, D.C. Well, my colleague Tim Franks asked him how much of a problem this type of fishing is as regards the release of carbon.
This is potentially one of the major sources of marine carbon released into the atmosphere. Until now, we didn't know that emissions that are created underwater, like bottom trawling, actually are released into the atmosphere.
Right. So you've been able to calculate both how this happens and also in what sort of quantity?
Yes. We estimated on a study a couple of years ago that bottom trawling, by disturbing, by scraping the sediment on the seafloor and the carbon in it, part of that carbon turns into carbon dioxide. And that amount of carbon dioxide every year is potentially on the same order of magnitude as global aviation.
Good grief. I mean, that is extraordinary.
It is an enormous amount of emissions that have been unaccounted for to date. And of course, we need more studies to verify our first results. But this is potentially a source of emissions that is too big to ignore.
Right. I mean, you know, people have been complaining about this type of fishing for a long time because we know that it can destroy the habitats under in the sea, at the bottom of the sea. Given what you're talking about in terms of the how it can help drive climate change as well, I mean, are there, I realise this isn't probably part of your scientific research, but are there efforts made to try and limit the use of this technique?
Not really. Actually, this technique is subsidised by governments with taxpayers' money. There was another study released last week showing that the United Kingdom government is subsidizing fishing with 150 to 180 million pounds every year.
Given that you have now come up with this research, I mean, presumably you're hoping that there will be a recalculation for just the sort of cost to this type of fishing.
No, absolutely. Bottom trawling is this technique that uses these heavy nets scouring the seafloor, destroying everything in its path until you have nothing but mud. And also, it is economically unprofitable because without government subsidies, many of these bottom trawling fisheries would not be profitable. And third, now we know it has a climate impact that is similar to the emissions that we are used to, terrestrial emissions that end up in the atmosphere.
That was the marine ecologist Enrique Sala. Next, the latest instalment in our reporting on the movie and TV awards season. The nominations for the BAFTAs, which recognises the UK stars and productions, are out, and Oppenheimer looks set to continue its dominance. The epic about the development of the atomic bomb has 13 nominations. Here's Colin Patterson.
This is a national emergency.
Oppenheimer, Christopher Nolan's three-hour epic about the birth of the atomic bomb. Hugely long, hugely successful at the box office, and now hugely rewarded by BAFTA with 13 nominations.
We imagine a future
And our imaginings horrify us.
Including Best Actor for Cillian Murphy and recognition in the supporting categories for Emily Blunt and Robert Downey Jr. There was also a strong showing by Poor Things.
She's an experiment.
Good evening.
The Dark Fantasy has 11 nominations, with Emma Stone in Best Actress, although its director, Yorgos Lanthimos, was left out of the Best Director category. And that wasn't the only notable snub. Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, about the murder of Native Americans in 1920s Oklahoma, may have had 9 nominations, but its stars, Lily Gladstone and Leonardo DiCaprio, both missed out, although Robert De Niro did secure his first acting nomination since Goodfellas 33 years ago. And it was a surprise to many that the biggest box office hit of the year, Barbie, was not included in Best Picture.
Hi, Barbie!
Its total of 5 nominations was the same achieved by another very different film, directed by one of Barbie's cast. Emerald Fennell played Barbie's friend Midge. She also wrote and directed Saltburn, a twisted British satire about class and privilege, which is in the running for Outstanding British Film.
Saltburn is an entirely British crew. We were over 50% women on our cast and crew as well, which meant a great deal to us.
The winners will be announced on the 18th of February.
Colin Paterson on the BAFTAs. Now, false teeth belonging to Britain's wartime Prime Minister Winston Churchill are going up for auction here in the UK. They're expected to be sold for more than $10,000. The gold-mounted teeth, which were constructed to preserve Churchill's distinctive speaking style, are one of a handful of sets made for him. The upper dentures date from around the start of the Second World War. Claire Runacres has more.
Sir Winston Churchill was better known for his rousing speeches than for his terrible teeth. He lost several in his 20s, so opted for false ones to fill the gaps. When his dentures were made, he ensured his distinctive lisp, which had developed in childhood, would remain. Liz Poole, who is a director at the Cotswold Auction House, where the false teeth are being sold, describes what this set looks like.
Some people call it a bridge. So it's not a full set of dentures. It's a sort of curved piece of gold that would curve up into the top of the mouth with 2 loops that hooked over a tooth on either side. And then there's 4 teeth together and then a gap and another 2. So he obviously had 6 teeth taken out and these would fill in the gap.
It's thought to be one of 3 or 4 identical sets he owned. It's said he liked to carry 2 on his person at any one time. One set is buried with him, another's in a museum, and this one goes up for sale next month.
Claire Runacres on a very famous set of false teeth. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email, of course. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And you can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.